Disclaimer, the views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in the show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. Hey everybody, welcome to Ancast. I'm Zach Birchie. Joining me as always, Justin Tsevakis.
Hey.
And our guest this week, kind of a legend. I don't think that's an overstatement. A guy who's been around the anime and manga industry for a very long time. He's a manga editor at Dark Horse now and has been for quite a while. It's Carl Horn. Carl, thanks a lot for coming by.
Hey, thanks you very much for having me on the show. Talking to you right now from the office in Milwaukee, Oregon. We're just a little south of Portland, as seen on IFC.
Right, yeah. Right. So you've got such a long history. I kind of want to start from the very beginning. What turned you on to manga in the first place? I mean, I don't even know how many years ago we're talking at this point.
Well, I should say, you know, that Michael Gombos, who's our director of Asian licensing here at Dark Horse, he's a big fan of ANNcast, and he kind of encouraged me to do the show. But he was kind of asking me the other day, like, so what do they want to talk to you about? And I said, well, I don't know. I think it's like the old days. And he said, old days? You mean like 2006? You know, and then nostalgia about the manga boom.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, you know, like a lot of people, I was an anime fan before I was a manga fan. Mm. I got into anime the way most American kids did in Iran.
Oh.
What?
Oh, yeah. Our family moved there in 1973. We were there to build a new terminal on Mehrabad International Airport. Now, in Tokyo terms, Mehrabad's kind of like the Haneda of Tokyo, if that makes sense.
Mm.
You know, closer into town. Narita would be Imam Khomeini Airport. Wasn't called it back then. But anyway, there was American television on Channel 7, Armed Forces Radio Television Service, known to AFARTS, you know, on Channel 7. And they would show Speed Racer. And unlike a lot of kids who grew up saying that they didn't know that anime was Japanese, my parents told me, hey, this is from Japan, because probably they could recognize the names and the credits and all that. Now, when I was that age, being Japanese didn't mean too much to me, you know, because there weren't too many Japanese people in Iran, although there were a few. But, you know, it was kind of a, you know, indicator early on of like there being a larger world out there. And it's kind of something that stayed with me my whole life as an anime fan, because, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're Iranian, French, you know, Argentinian, we're all equally gaijin to the Japanese. And
right.
there are fans of anime everywhere in the world. I was in London, like, not too long ago, running this dude, this black English guy. His family came over from Trinidad. We're both otaku, so it's like Masonic handshake. You know, instantly, despite our different backgrounds, we can all talk about the same thing. And I've actually, you know, I bring about Iran, I actually got a fan letter from someone who said they took a copy of Excel Saga, a manga I edited to Iran. Iranian dude. He lives in England, goes back and forth, his family. And he took a picture of him holding up a copy of Excel Saga over the Caspian Sea. And I'm thinking, whoa, I mean, getting that through customs, that's pretty cool. you know, you guys at ANN, you know about this. If you look at the ANN encyclopedia, you have a lot of listings of the Arabic names of anime shows. Someone's contributing that. There's so many anime shows that never showed in North America that were shown in the Arabic and Persian-speaking world. I mean, they got to see, like, Nadia was on TV over there, Rose of Versailles.
I hear, you know, Captain Tsubasa was huge over there.
Oh, yeah, Captain Tsubasa, I mean, because, you know, Americans, we kind of lack the soccer gene, but, you know, everyone else has it.
Right.
So, yeah. Future Boy Conan, only in Arabic he's called Adnan. So, you know, that's how it goes.
Insert pun here.
Exactly. So it may seem like a funny place to, like, discover anime, but, you know, if it's not in Japan, every place is funny.
Right.
I mean, you know, so that's kind of an early lesson. My family moved around the world a lot. We came back to the U.S. in 1982, and that's where I kind of discovered manga. Barefoot Gen was actually the first manga I discovered, and I guess it was one of the very first, you know, ever published. the series has been completed, I guess, by Last Gasp recently. People may not know it's a famous manga semi-autobiographical by Keiji Nakazawa, who was one of the survivors of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima. But it doesn't just talk about those events. It talks about everything that led up to it. The fact his family was anti-war and suffered quite a bit because of that. And the struggle to kind of rebuild after the war. But an interesting thing about Barefoot Gen is that it wasn't published for manga fans per se. It was published as a kind of educational anti-nuclear proliferation effort. And some of the most interesting manga that have been published in U.S. history have been not necessarily for the manga market, but for, you know, educational purposes, business education. You guys might know about Manga Gene magazine and so forth. Mm. And that's where you can find a lot of the offbeat stuff that gives you a broader picture. This was in the San Francisco Bay Area, and that was a very good place to be into anime and manga in the early 1980s because, of course, you had a very high concentration of Asian Americans, and anime and manga proliferated to Asia before it proliferated to other parts of the world. And, of course, you had not one but two Japantowns in the Bay Area, not only the one in San Francisco, but a much smaller one down in San Jose. So, you know, basically that's where it started for me in the early 80s in the Bay Area.
And what kind of stuff were you into at the time?
Well, when I was a kid, I was into, like, you know, role-playing games. This is, like, when Advanced Dungeons & Dragons first became big, you know, back in the late 70s.
Right, right.
So the first conventions I would go to would be gaming conventions. So I'm, like, 10 or 11 years old, right? And there was this room, and they were showing, like, you know, videos. And all of a sudden, I said, oh, what's that? And, like, I sat down, and, like, I couldn't get away from this thing. It was Space Pirate Captain Harlock, which about the only way to get subtitled anime in those days was it was showing on Honolulu's television. I believe it's KIKU television in Honolulu. And naturally, there's a very big Japanese-American community in Hawaii. So they would get anime and tokusatsu, you know, shows like Ultraman and Super Sentai shows, and often they'd be subtitled in English. So if there was a pen pal or you knew someone who did have a pen pal in Hawaii, they could send the tapes over to the U.S., and that's how we'd get to see series like that. So someone at this gaming convention was running a video show where they were showing Harlock, and it was at that point that I found out about the CFO, which was the first sort of English-language fan network, you know, in the United States. And you guys know about the CFO.
Oh, yes. But
our listeners may not.
Okay, well, you know, one of the ironies about being an anime fan in the U.S. is probably more people got to see anime on TV in the 1960s than they do today. Of course, most of the important anime shows in the 1960s all showed on American television back then, often just a few months after they came out in Japan. We're talking shows like Astro Boy, Kimba the White Lion, Prince Planet, Marine Boy, Eighth Man, you know, a lot of Tezuka's real classics in there. And these were syndicated by NBC in many cases, and there wasn't so much competition in those days. There was very little cable. There was obviously no digital satellite. So people got a lot more exposure to anime back then. That was kind of before my time. And after the 60s, there was kind of this 10-year gap when there wasn't really any new anime coming to U.S. television. That didn't end until the late 70s when you had Battle of the Planets, a.k.a. Gatchaman, and Star Blazers coming to U.S. TV. But in that time, the first anime clubs really kind of rose up. There was and it started in Los Angeles, naturally, because that was where the science fiction and animation fan community was located, you know, Hollywood being there and so forth. The CFO, which stood for the Cartoon Fantasy Organization, was founded in 1977 by guys like Fred Patton and Mark Merlino. And by the early 80s, there was a kind of a network of clubs, small clubs across the United States, where people were watching anime, having regular meetings. And of course, back then, it was all done with, you know, VHS tapes or beta tapes. This is far before there was any kind of, you know, digital distribution. You literally had to gather in some central point, you know, back then to watch anime. So I wasn't really of that first generation. I was kind of at the generation that kind of rebelled or reacted to that generation. When I got into the CFO, like in the 83, 84, first of all, I was like, you know, 12 or 13. And like many people that age, I didn't really have any time for like old people, and old people were like anybody over like 16. So like, you know, and I'm sure I didn't appreciate everything that he had done to kind of build up anime and manga in the US. All I would do is I'd like go into some meeting and there'd be a bunch of guys sitting on a couch, you know, kind of vegetating, and I'd be like all excited and hyper. You know, like I want to go out and skate or something, you know. And just,
were you screaming internet jokes? There was, I'm kidding.
No, this is before the internet.
Right.
So like 300 baud, you know, back then and all that.
Right. You were just screaming LOL because that was new at the time.
This is like 1983. I'm
still kidding.
I know. You know, anime, I was always the youngest person at the club meetings. Like, and again, like when you're that age, when you're like 13, everybody seems old. So, you know, they probably weren't that old, the other people there. But like, I just couldn't, you know, anime seems so much more exciting than just sitting around and watching it. Like, had to do something, you know, get out there. And I've always liked people who were kind of on the, not, who were doing things with anime, like, you know, skaters, punks, ravers. I mean, later on, the rave scene would really adopt anime in a big way. And I always liked people who were kind of taking anime and not just watching it, but kind of doing something with it, like, you know, making zines, you know, having events, you know, having parties, that sort of thing. So although organized anime fandom began in L.A., Berkeley was kind of a center, appropriately enough, of rebellion against it. Berkeley was kind of a really excellent place to be an anime fan because you had so much going on there. First of all, in Berkeley, you had the UC Theater, which was one of the only theaters in the U.S. that would regularly show anime. You probably heard of, like, you know, seen the old Galaxy Express dub by Roger Corman, or the very old dub of the first Lupin film, Mamo. You know that guy, you know that dub?
Oh, yeah. The really old, scratchy gel dub.
Exactly. But that used to show in 35 millimeter there. They would get the print straight from, you know, Los Angeles, from the film rental office. They would show Warriors of the Wind, you know, that was showing there. You know, it was kind of depressing if you'd seen Nausicaa.
Right.
For those who don't know, Warriors of the Wind was a severely edited version of Nausicaa, the Valley of Wind. Right. This is years before, you know, Ghibli had like a formal rollout of their films in the U.S. Okay, so anyway, in Berkeley, you had the UC Theater. You had a very famous comic shop called Comics and Comics. And they were a place which was always ordering the latest anime magazines, the books and the Roman albums, the anime film comics. There was a guy there behind the counter named Mike Ebert, and he was the guy responsible for making sure that they were ordering all this Japanese import stuff. And there's one thing that was indisputably better about being an anime fan in, say, 1985, and that's the exchange rate was 300 yen to the dollar.
Oh,
Jesus. So.
Oh, that sounds so nice.
Exactly. Right. So literally your money was going four times as far. And, you know, so even a kid who just, you know, was, you know, doing part-time jobs could afford to buy some of this, you know, this import gear. And Mike was a super nice guy. He would, like, even though I was just this kid coming into the comic shop, he would do things like lend me his imported VHS tapes from Japan, or like Giant Gorg. You know, he bought it all on VHS from Bandai Visual. He'd lend me his soundtracks. Back then it was like LP albums and all that. So when people are starting off often as anime fans, you know, you have to count on someone to be like that kind of generous and that open. He was kind of like my Kamina. He was like the coolest dude I'd met who was like into anime. So especially when you're that age, you need a kind of older brother type to look up to. But more than that, he had kind of like ambitions to start a anime magazine. Back then, the new magazine was New Type. New Type had started in 1985. And New Type was very like dynamic. It had these double page spreads, which was something it had adapted from Life magazine in the US. And it was this really exciting way of looking at anime. And the 80s were a tremendously exciting time for anime because so many new and experimental shows were coming out. So we had this idea. Mike Ebert was one of the people who had this idea. Let's, as American fans, let's make some kind of magazine that looks like New Type, you know, at least in a modest way. And this is the dawn of desktop publishing with the Mac. Mm. So it's like, oh, wow, man, you can lay out three columns of text. So this was the origin of the fanzine known as Animag that you might have heard of. Mm. And Animag was printed with full color covers. It had some interior color. And like New Type, it had fully painted original covers. Mike Ebert was doing it. Schulhoff Tom was doing it. They even commissioned Yoshiyuki Sadamoto to do an original cover of Gainax's film Royal Space Force, which is new at the time, to do a cover for issue 3. So, again, we're talking 1986, 1987 in Berkeley, and they're making this magazine called Animag. Now, I'm just hanging out as kind of his assistant and like, you know, can I help out doing this and that? You know, I didn't really know too much. But just the ability to kind of be in this area was exciting. Now, a few blocks away over on the campus of UC Berkeley, you have CalAnimage. CalAnimage was the anime club of the University of California system. And the very first club was, naturally enough, at UC Berkeley, CalAnimage Alpha. Now, the people who founded Anime Expo, they come out of CalAnimage. Mike Tatsugawa, who was the chairman for many years of the SPGA, he went to Cal, and many of the people there did as well. And at one point, CalAnimage Alpha at Berkeley was the largest anime club in the English-speaking world. They were getting 400 people a week there at their meetings. And, you know, at times it was kind of like a live-action, you know, Genshiken, you know, the scene there.
Right.
But so, you know, you had all these things going on. And in addition to that, you had a comic store, another comic store called Comic Relief, which was run by the late Rory Root. He was the first person I ever knew who made active efforts to promote manga in comic stores. And I mean, he was doing this in 1988. You know, when First Comics in Chicago was putting out Lone Wolf and Cub in 1987, when Epic Comics, a subsidiary of Marvel, was putting out Akira in 1988, he was putting it up at the front of the store. So he was making clear that, like, manga had a place for comics fans. So just out of being lucky enough to live in the East Bay of the San Francisco area, you know, there was kind of this idea that, yeah, we're going to kind of make this, you know, we're going to make this new world as fans.
You were basically around for the start of what eventually became modern anime fandom. That sounds like it was sort of the epicenter, especially, you know, you're a couple of blocks from the most, probably the most well-known and heavily populated anime club in the country for many, many years. And with all that going on, I mean, that's like the birth of it right there.
Yeah, there's something I should say. I mean, I know there are people listening who are from New York, who are from Boston, who are from San Antonio, who are from L.A., other parts of the country. And wherever you are always seems like the axis of history. You know, like this story could be told differently depending on where you were in the United States or where you were in the world. You know, I don't mean to suggest that the Bay Area is where everything got started and all that, because I know that's not true, you know. And that's why I wanted to talk about the CFO and the people who came before me. And also the fact that, like, again, I probably didn't appreciate them at the time. But, you know, when you're young, you got to kind of rebel. You got to kind of, you know, move on. It's just appropriate. So Animag, by 87 or so, there were two or three issues of it out. Oh, yeah, I haven't even talked about Artalsorian Games. You know, I talked about how I got into anime through being a gamer. Well, Artalsorian was a gaming company that came up with Mecton, which a lot of people might have heard of. This is like, Mecton was like 86, 87, and it was a role-playing game for people who wanted to role-play like a Gundam or like a Votoms or a Dugrum. Basically, people who wanted to do tabletop role-playing of mecha combat. And the same people who were involved in Animag were involved in Artalsorian Games. So they watched these shows and they knew what they were talking about. So those guys were down, you know, they were also in Berkeley and later in Emeryville. So, but to get back to Animag, by 87, there were three issues of it out. And that's when I went to Japan for the first time. I was 16. And I was able to go over there. There was a really wonderful man. He just died a few years ago. His name was Hideo Ogata. He was at Tokuma Shoten, the famous publisher who's been associated with Studio Ghibli for a long time. Mr. Ogata was the editor-in-chief of Animeiji magazine. And he always was very strong on outreach to international fans. Animeiji always had, like, you know, they were always open to American fans writing in. You can find letters that, like, Torrance Smith sent to, like, Animeiji in 1985 and so forth, and they would publish them. So I went over there in 1987, you know, and brought some copies of Animag, in part because I wanted to show Mr. Ogata, like, hey, this is what we're doing over in America. You know, we think what you're doing is really cool, and, you know, we're trying to live up to it somehow. And, you know, wonderful guy, you know, gave me an interview, which, you know, later put into Animag. And he said, hey, do you want to go, like, you know, meet some animators? So he said, I'm going to call up Mr. Otsuka. And this is Yasuo Otsuka of Tokyo Movie Shinsha. Mr. Otsuka is a very longtime collaborator with Hayao Miyazaki. He was the animation director for The Castle of Cagliostro, the first Lupin film. And actually, if you have the Cagliostro disc, I believe Mr. Otsuka did the commentary track on there. Otsuka-san speaks English fluently. He's a big Jeep fan, the old World War II Army Jeep, probably the biggest Jeep otaku in the world. And just as Miyazaki loves planes, Mr. Otsuka loves cars. And he's the person who's responsible for all the, you know, wild, distinctive car models in Lupin over the years. So Mr. Ogata gave me the introduction. I went to Tokyo Movie Shinsha, and Mr. Otsuka, and again, I'm just like this 16-year-old kid. He's giving me like an hour of his time and talking about the new Lupin production, which at the time was Plot of the Fuuma Clan. And this was Lupin's return to anime after several years. This was 1987 in OAV. You may know that Mamoru Oshii was originally going to direct the third Lupin film, but it didn't pan out. That was, you know, a real shame, I think.
Yeah, it would have been interesting to see.
That would have been one weird movie.
I think the idea was going to be that Lupin was going to steal reality. So, yes, it does sound very much like an Oshii.
Of course.
But, like, yeah, people have kind of the wrong idea about Oshii. Oshii was like Mamoru-chan back then. He was like this, you know, he was this kind of iconic figure, but he wasn't necessarily this kind of mysterious and unapproachable guy. Remember, this is before the Pat Labor movies. You know, this is before Ghost in the Shell. And sure, he made The Angel's Egg, but most people knew him as the guy who had directed Urusei Yatsura, which people loved.
Only starts getting pretentious and crazy in the movies.
Exactly. As, you know, Gerald Rathkolb said, you know, there's two things that Oshii is really good at, you know, comedy and action. It's too bad he doesn't do with them anymore. So, but although I heard that he is returning to comedy, you know, for his new work. So anyway, getting to talk to Mr. Ogata, getting to talk to Mr. Otsuka gave me confidence as a kid that, you know, hey, I could be in this industry somehow. I can be involved with it. And it's really, you know, I hadn't actually done anything or accomplished anything besides being a fan. So I owe it basically to these people who were in the anime industry in Japan who were very friendly and open-hearted towards the gaijin. And, you know, although Japan may not be very accepting of foreigners in general, there are people in the industry who have always felt that it's an international thing and kind of a global language. So I don't think that exclusionary attitude is quite as strong when it comes to anime, when it comes to manga. There is kind of more of a sense of a common culture. So I'm really grateful to those people who gave me encouragement, you know, back in the day. But of course, this was 1987, and there was no anime industry in the U.S. That wouldn't get started till 1990 when, you know, Dangayo and Gunbuster came out from U.S. renditions. A funny thing, by the way, about that. So I believe the first anime that got released on home video in the U.S., right, was Dangayo and Gunbuster. came out from US Renditions, and it was like $34.95 on VHS, two episodes. So that's like 1990. So if you adjust for inflation, it's like, what, $60 today? Okay, $60 for two episodes. What does that remind you of?
Oh, Region 2.
Right. So they were pushing Japanese price models even back then. So it's not a new thing, you know. You know, I don't want to like emphasize this point because people are always looking for better value, but you really do pay less for anime and manga, all things considered, than you used to. All through the VHS era, you know, it was pretty standard to get two episodes on tape. And, you know, it might be like $29.95 or so. And if you wanted the subtitle version, of course, you had to buy a different tape, you know, maybe.
For I don't think anyone's arguing that things are more expensive than they used to be, at least no one that actually knows anything.
Yeah. What I mean is, you know, obviously people have budgets, you know, and a lot of people who buy anime are young and don't have a lot of money. I'll just point out it does actually cost less, you know, than it used to. But anyway, so 1987, there was no anime industry yet, and the manga industry was just getting started. The first manga to be published on a regular basis in the U.S. was Lone Wolf and Cub. That was published by First Comics in Chicago, which doesn't exist anymore. But manga publishing got started here in the 80s because, in part, there was something called the black and white boom. The black and white boom was something that really was encouraged by the success of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Now, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles became this huge TV show and multimedia phenomenon. But before it was all that, it was this kind of self-published black and white comic that was kind of a riff on the influences that were coming into comics in the 80s. Basically, you know, samurai, ninja. Frank Miller in the early 80s had done a comic called Ronin. Miller was one of the very early people to be into manga. He was a big fan of Lone Wolf and Cub. But to set the thing, you know, the 80s different, you know, the 80s were kind of a different time as far as Japan was concerned. You can kind of compare the way people looked at America, the way people looked at Japan in the 80s, to the way they look at China today. Japan was kind of seen as a bit of a threat in the 1980s, a geopolitical contender. There was a huge trade deficit with Japan. Japan was buying iconic buildings like Rockefeller Center in New York. They were buying Columbia Pictures. There was this kind of fear, basically, that Japan was taking over and that Japan was buying our politicians and we were all going to work for the Japanese. Now that's all forgotten today, and now it's the Chinese we're all going to be working for, and so forth. Right. But at the time, it kind of gave a weird vibe to being an anime fan, because there was kind of this sense that it wasn't just this kind of culture, it was also this kind of political threat. You know, older people who'd like see me watching anime would say stuff like, you know, depending on their age, they say stuff like, you know, hey, remember Pearl Harbor? Or they'd say stuff like, well, you know, I don't really get this Japanese cartoons, but I guess, you know, we're all going to be working for them sooner or later. So, hey, this kid's got an early start. Back then, the mainstream media would rarely report on stuff like anime or manga. Instead, it was all like, when it was about Japan, it was about big corporations and like banks and like, you know, Mitsubishi and Toyota.
Right.
The whole idea of cool Japan was far in the future.
This was the Gung-Ho starring Michael Keaton era.
Exactly. I like you. You make me laugh. You know?
For what it's worth, I got Remember Pearl Harbor well into the 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, World War II, you know, big event, still being echoed, you know, through anime and all that. But, yeah, so there was that kind of odd vibe. But really, 1987, I started college, and there was no realistic sense then of going into the industry because it hardly existed. So I went to college, and I guess I had this kind of idea that someday I would be involved in international business and so forth, you know, and then kind of get back into it. But in 87, my favorite anime film came out. It was Gainax's first film, Royal Space Force, also known as The Wings of Onyamas. And this movie kind of blew me away. So I kind of quickly developed the idea that everybody should see this movie. So I thought, well, they're going to see it, but it's kind of hard for people to understand. I know, what if it were translated in some fashion, like what if it were subtitled? This goes into kind of the history of fan subtitling. As far as I know, the first anime to ever be fan subtitled was the 1984 Macross film, Do You Remember Love? It was, I think it was subtitled in 1986. And at the time, there was no, nobody had really a home computer set up where that kind of thing was possible. If you wanted to actually subtitle an anime film, you'd have to go rent time in like a TV studio. And TV studios had subtitling equipment, but they generally were set up to just do things like, you know, the titles for end credits on a show or something. The idea of actually subtitling an entire two-hour movie was not contemplated. There were foreign films that were subtitled, but they didn't subtitle them on video. They actually subtitled them on a film print. You know, they were burned in, you know, it was a burned in print. And you may see old subtitle films that look like that. There used to be a few anime films that were subtitled and that were floating around. The Castle Cagliostro was subtitled. Space Adventure Cobra was subtitled. My Youth in Arcadia was subtitled. These were probably done for film festivals, you know, back in the early 80s. And sooner or later, these movies leaked out onto VHS, and these were kind of precious artifacts for fans in the 80s because it was very difficult to get any kind of translation. But in 86, 87 or so, a computer system called the Amiga came out. Now, I didn't have one, but I knew some people who did. Amiga was one of the first systems that could actually handle video processing. There was a device called a Genlock. A Genlock is for syncing two video signals. Now, you have to understand how limited the memory was in these machines. They had like maybe 1 megabyte of memory. So it was completely out of the question of the idea of this material being stored digitally and processed digitally. When I talk about using a computer for fan subtitling, I mean that you would hook up a source like a LaserDisc player, because LaserDisc would be the best source for an anime. This is before DVDs. And you would run it through the computer in real time. So it would be the signal would run through the computer would sync the subtitle with the image, and then the image would go out onto the recording medium, which would be like VHS or Super Beta. So in other words, there was no digitalization of the signal at any time. It remained analog. You were just like sort of stamping the subtitle on it, as it were, as it passed through. So basically, there was a script floating around on the internet, and this is back when the internet was all text. This is, you know, Usenet back then for Royal Space Force. And I had the idea, hey, we could subtitle this somehow. So once again, we go back to Berkeley. There used to be a store on Telegraph Avenue called Winner's Circle, which had the Amiga. And I was able somehow to kind of talk to the people there and use their stuff, you know, basically, you know, make friends with them and all that. You know, I couldn't afford those computers. But we actually managed to create a subtitled version of this film. And in terms of like timing, forget it. There was no timing. It was all done manually. So basically you press a space key when the person talked, and that would like advance the next subtitle. And remember I talked about there being only 1 megabyte of memory? There was only enough memory for about 100 subtitles at a time. And there were something like 1,200 lines of dialogue in Royal Space Force. So what we had to do is do it in 12 parts. So say 10 minutes into the film, we'd stop the film, and the VCR we're recording it on has a flying erase head, which meant that you could toggle to individual frames. So you'd stop it there and, you know, find a good point and hope no one notices the edit. So you do that 12 times, you know, and hope your timing is not too off, because there'd be kind of a hang time. But we didn't even think about those things back then. There was no fan subtitling scene. There were like no standards for fan subtitling. It was just, we want to make this film better known. And we didn't even want to, like, the whole idea of there being fan subtitling groups, we put our group's name on the film. We didn't actually put it on the film itself. We actually waited till the credits were over and then like waited 2 seconds. And then we put up our names. It was like, we didn't actually, it's not like we were trying to hide who we were, but we didn't want to say, this is our movie. We didn't want to say like in any way, like we made this or like we own it. Mm-hmm. years later, I would see like fan subs where they would like, okay, so it's like the opening credits to the TV show. And you look at the opening credits and they would translate the names, but they'd all be the names of the people who worked on the fan sub. Yep. They weren't the people, the names who made the show, you know. And we translated the names of all the opening credits. Now, it was only 15 names, but at least we got all the people in the opening credits right, you know, the character designer and all that. Because we wanted people to know who made the movie. That was the whole point of the exercise. So anyway, I brought this film down to is my sophomore year of college. And because of the CFO, like I said, that, you know, I had kind of a bad reaction to the club meetings. I didn't think they were all that cool. Imagine that, an anime fan, not thinking anime clubs are cool, you know. You know, but so I didn't want to start any kind of anime club because I never wanted people to think that you had to be in any kind of special group to watch anime. Because all I heard was, you know, hey, in Japan, this stuff's in the movie theaters. This stuff's on TV. You don't have to be in a club over there. Why should you have to be in a club here? So, you know, just like in college, you say, you put up flyers saying, hey, tonight we're going to show Animal House. Tonight we're going to show the Blues Brothers. Tonight we're going to show Raiders of the Lost Ark. I just put up flyers saying, tonight we're going to show The Wings of Onyamas. It's this, you know, anime film from Japan. It's really cool. It's subtitled. You know, it's going to be in Mud Blaisdell. It's going to be in Wig. Those are like the residence halls. And got 150 people in there. It filled it up. And, you know, The Wings of Onyamas was made by people who were sort of in college and barely out of college. And it was kind of made for people their own age. And people were watching this film and they were kind of digging it. They were kind of reacting to it. And that also gave me confidence. I thought, you know, hey, these are like my fellow students and they're liking this anime film. You know, this could like, this anime stuff could be accepted here. It could go further. So it was all part of the idea that kind of anime should be bigger than any type of organization or club. It should be for everybody, ideally. It should be for like everybody who can like possibly get into it. So anyway, I graduate, you know, college, and this is the early 90s, you know, this is slacker period, Generation X, you know. Went to go see Nirvana when they played, you know, at the Palladium in downtown LA, missed them and saw The Shame instead. but you know, totally Gen X, you know, grunge and all that, but also kind of the slacker thing. Like, there was a mild recession going on back then. It wasn't as bad as we have now. But there's this kind of idea, man, oh man, you know, we're not going anywhere. So like a lot of people, I graduated from college and I didn't really quite know what I was going to do. But I didn't forget about Royal Space Force. And I had this kind of idea that this came out in 1987. And by 1990, again, there started to be a home video anime market in the US. But I wasn't hearing anything about this movie coming out. And what I heard back in Japan from Japan was that, hey, this movie didn't do very good. So I thought maybe they're not interested in it. Maybe I could release it, you know. And again, the industry was so new that I didn't actually think that this was a stupid idea or that I couldn't do it. Because, again, like it wasn't established enough for me to say, how could I do it? So I was thinking in terms of like, well, how could it get into U.S.? And I thought about PBS. PBS, you know, was known for showing a lot of science fiction and imported shows. If you like British science fiction, like Doctor Who and Blake Seven, they were the first people to show that kind of stuff back in the day. And I knew they weren't afraid of like foreign television shows or subtitled. And PBS, of course, has channels across the U.S. So I thought this could be a ready-made venue, you know, for anime. And by the way, Evangelion, I believe the only time it ever showed subtitled on U.S. TV was on PBS, on KTH in San Jose. That's getting way ahead of the game. But so I had the idea, maybe this could be done as a nonprofit type of thing. So I applied to the Japan Foundation, you know, learned about grant writing and all that. A lot of people don't know this, but public television started in Houston, Texas, and that's where I was living at the time. So I went to the local PBS station in Houston, showed them the film. They were very encouraging about it, and they offered to sort of, you know, write me letters of support. And in the meantime, I was sending copies of this tape to, like, everybody I could think of who might want to help. again, I'm like extremely naive. I'm sending it to people like Steven Spielberg, not realizing, of course, that like Spielberg, Amblin Entertainment, they don't want to receive unsolicited material, you know, because they don't want people telling them, hey, you stole my idea. So, of course, they sent it right back with, you know, a polite note saying, you know, sorry, but kid, but we can't watch this. But I'd sent it to like Roger Ebert, and then Roger Ebert sends me back this postcard saying, I want to watch this, but I don't have time. You know, maybe I'll get around to it. But he actually took time to tell me that he didn't have time to see it. And as you know, Roger Ebert's always been like a big supporter of anime. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of an early clue that he was like, you know, open-minded about this stuff. So I was saying to David Putnam, to Harlan Ellison, anybody I could basically, you know, think of. So I started a nonprofit company in Texas named Giant X after Otaku no Video, you know, really original. And, you know, got my correspondence, you know, translated into Japanese and was sending it to Bandai. Now, what I didn't know around all this time is that Bandai, of course, had not forgotten about this film, which they produced.
They blew a ton of money on it.
They did. And it was the there's one of the great unsung heroes of the anime industry is one of the producers at Bandai Visual, Mr. Shigeru Watanabe. He is responsible for so many great anime films, Jinro, Pat Labor films. He was a great patron of Oshii. He's basically the guy who started the OAV. He's been very instrumental in the development of anime. And he, from all reports, he practically had a nervous breakdown during the making of Wings of Onyamas. But that's because he was trying to support the film, you know, against, you know, some people in the company who were against it. And saying, you know, let these guys do what they want, you know, let them, this is the young generation, man, you know, so, you know, let them do what they want. So basically, Bandai Visual, Wings of Onyamas did eventually make back its money. It made back its money in September of 1994, which was 7.5 years after it came out. But it made back its money. And ever since then, it has, you know, turned a slow and steady trickle of profit for Bandai. Bandai never gives up. And what I didn't know at all this time was that Bandai was planning to release this film in the U.S. So I'm sending these letters to Bandai, and like Bandai is getting back to me. Who are you? Are you on the stock exchange? You know, what's your credit rating? You know, let's see some bank information. You know, because again, I'm this like kid, you know, with this nonprofit organization and these totally naive ideas. And I go to Akon in Dallas. I believe this is Akon 4. And I run into someone you talk with just recently, Kenny Yodomi. And Mr. Yodomi, it turns out, was going to start getting involved with Manga Entertainment, which at the time was a British company. They were going to start releasing anime in the U.S. And it turned out that one of the titles that they were going to start with was Royal Space Force. So at this point, I kind of sheepishly hand him a copy of my fan sub and say, hey, you know, Mr. Yodomi, I really like this film, and, you know, I would love to help you promote it and get involved with it. So that was how I got involved with the anime industry. And basically, I sort of achieved what I wanted to achieve in kind of a roundabout fashion. Because, again, my goal was always to see that movie got out, officially released. Back then, with fan subtitling, that wasn't like, it wasn't fan subtitling for its own sake. It was basically the idea that we want this film to come out somehow, to have like a real release. And that's always what I've thought about, like kind of fan efforts, that, you know, we should all be striving towards the industry. Sometimes people ask me, like, what should I do to get into the industry? Like, what should I be studying and all that? And really my advice, and this may sound kind of flip, but like, think about starting your own company. Everybody has to start somewhere. And if you start off with modest ambitions to release a manga, a anime, maybe you can do it. You know, put it together, you know, use the resources you have. Let's say you're at a college, for example. A lot of colleges have university presses. Manga have been published by nonprofit entities before. What about getting your college to get the rights to a manga, publishing it as kind of an academic exercise? You know, there are all kinds of alternate models. You know, getting involved in the industry, because the industry is so small, it's really a matter of acquiring business knowledge and creating opportunity as well. You just can't sort of sit back and hope that somebody is going to get you a job. That may happen, but you'd be better off trying to create your own business, your own job opportunity. So I've gone off into one entirely different track. So there's a different track, and that goes back to like Animag and all that. You know, where did that leave off? Okay. So back to the internet, back to Usenet and all that. So Usenet had a bunch of interest groups. I think they're still around anymore. You know, it's all this Unix stuff. But there used to be interest groups that had names like Rec Arts Anime.
Uh-huh.
They had funny names like that because they were organized as hierarchies. So basically everything under rec, short for recreation, then there'd be all these like subcategories. So arts would be a subcategory of rec, and then anime is a subcategory of arts. So Rec Arts Anime. And that was basically the hangout on the internet back in the early 90s, if you want to just talk about anime, for the few hundred people who were like online and so forth. And that's kind of funny, by the way, because when Wings of Onyamas was released by Manga Entertainment in 1994, and when it first hit U.S. theaters, the internet was so new back then that if you actually look at the pull quotes of the advertisements they run in the paper, it would say, "The best anime of all time," then in tiny print, "anime fans, comma, the internet." And in 1994, all you had to say was "the internet." I'm like, oh, they're saying that on the internet? And, you know, you could still say that back then. And there were polls back then. There'd be annual polls in Rec Arts Anime. And, you know, 92, 93, 94, it was, you know, ranked the best anime film ever. I'm sure today it would be a different movie, you know, because times have changed. But so I would write regularly about anime and manga on there while I was doing my various, you know, slacker, you know, part-time jobs in Houston. And one night, a local bar in Houston called Laveau's, named after Marie Laveau, the voodoo queen of New Orleans, had an anime night. Okay, to get people in, you know, well drinks and anime. And I'm thinking, awesome, 60 drunk rednecks watching Legend of the Overfiend. This I got to see. So it was, you know, Legend of the Overfiend and I believe the anime version of Wounded Man. So that's entertainment. So I went there, sat through it, wrote down my experiences, and I wrote a little article on it called Overfiend Night at Laveau's. And way over in San Francisco, Trish Ledoux, who was the editor of Animag, had just started up a magazine with Viz called Animerica. Animerica got started because Animag was started, you know, in 86, 87 and ran through the early 90s, but it had a lot of distribution difficulties and, you know, it was only able to put out issues occasionally. And Trish had ambitions to do a regular magazine, you know, monthly. And she realized basically the only way to do that would be to have the backing of a company behind it. So Viz, which had started to publish manga regularly in 1987, decided to get into the magazine business. So many of the people who were at Animag, such as Julie Davis and Trish Ledoux again, became involved with Animerica. So in 1993, when I posted this article into the net, there were a few issues of Animerica out, and Trish Ledoux sent me an email saying, "Hey, would you like to start writing articles for Animerica?" So I started writing reviews, and all this time I was thinking about becoming a lawyer, because again, the idea of working in this industry was still kind of, you know, it hadn't really materialized. You know, so few people were in it. At this point, I was thinking, I'm going to be a lawyer. I'll get involved in like intellectual property. And then after I become a lawyer, I can become involved with anime and manga somehow. So I went to University of Santa Clara Law School. They had a really good IP program. But at that time, I was already writing for Animerica. And so you go to law school, right? You have to pay tuition. You know, it's big, you know, big student loans. And I'm writing all these papers in law school. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, I'm having to pay these guys to write, whereas Animerica is paying me to write. What's up with that? And, you know, these student loans are getting so high that if I don't jump off this, you know, this tilting board trap, I'm going to have no choice but to be a lawyer. I'll have to be a lawyer to pay back these loans. So kind of in 95, I made the decision, you know, you know what? I'm going to take my chances and like try to work in this industry somehow. And that's when I became a regular editor at An America magazine. I know I'm leaving off something here, but yeah, it's yeah. So those are kind of the parallel tracks. I mean, getting involved with the anime industry and getting involved kind of with writing on the anime industry. And it may seem like there's not much of a firewall between them, but it was kind of hard to avoid because, of course, Viz itself was involved in anime releasing. You know, they released Rama 1/2 and Masani Koku and, you know, Please Save My Earth, not to mention a whole bunch of manga and so forth. But Animerica was very serious about anime journalism. And there was so much to catch up with in 93, 94, but they had a very aggressive campaign of interviewing people in the industry in Japan. And of course, Egan Liu, you know, is one of the wonderful news stars of ANN, but Egan was also one of the guys in Animerica.
Right.
And through him and also people, do you guys know Takayuki Karahashi? Yeah,
very well.
Yeah, we do.
We just had lunch with him.
Right. Taka is one of those guys that you really want to be your interpreter when you have Japanese guests on an anime panel. A lot of cons, of course, they'll have interpreters and they'll have someone who speaks Japanese, which is great. But to really interpret most effectively, you've got to have someone who is familiar with the industry, knows its jargon, knows the references. And that way you save so much time because you don't have to explain the questions. So if someone asks Taka a question, he understands what you're getting at, you know, and so forth. So Taka was one of the, you know, people at Animerica. Toshifumi Yoshida, of course, who was producer of many of the Viz dubs. He's also a great, you know, panel interpreter. He translates the Kurosagi Corpse delivery service for Dark Horse. But, you know, interviewing people like Mamoru Oshii and Hayao Miyazaki and Noboru Ishiguro. By 1995, we were able to put out a book called Animerica Interviews, which I think is still one of the great sources for anime research. And again, these are all interviews with Japanese people, mangaka, anime directors. It was kind of an interesting time, you know, to be an anime fan, because if you go back to Anime Expo 1996, there were only something like 2,000 people there. But look at the guests. Mamoru Oshii, Hideaki Anno, Kenichi Sonoda, Noboru Ishiguro. You know, imagine having the director of Macross and the director of Ghost in the Shell and the director of Evangelion, and they're all there at the same con. And yeah. There were very few American guests. There were even very few Japanese voice actor guests. Back then, there was a very heavy concentration on people who were directors, character designers, script writers, people who were very directly involved in the creation of the anime in Japan. Now, of course, there also were very few fans coming, and maybe there is something to the fact that only a small percentage of fans are really interested in those people, that, you know, more fans are interested in the seiyuu and also, you know, the American side of that, the voice actors.
Right.
But imagine going to Expo 96, and this is just between the Evangelion television series and the movie, and very few people had seen Evangelion yet in the U.S. This is the only time Anno ever came to the U.S. after Evangelion. And that was where he made a lot of his famous remarks, like, you know, the person who said he sold all his money to buy his school books to buy anime goods. He said, "You're a fool, you know, study harder." But Anno was pretty tense. But, like, people who didn't know what was going on in Japan, all the controversy, might not have appreciated why he was so tense. The series was still, it hadn't really become this big phenomenon yet in this kind of, you know, familiar, friendly thing, which it is today. We're just like, hey, Asuka, Shinji, Rei, you know. Back then it was this kind of, you know, disturbing, controversial type of work.
Well, you know, that did bring to mind, it sounds like, you know, Wings of Aniamis was sort of the first thing that, you know, aside from just generally being a fan, was the first thing you saw that kind of blew your mind. And I would venture, I guess, it sounds like Evangelion maybe was the next thing that had that kind of impact on you.
Well, actually, you know, there were anime that really made an impact on me before Royal Space Force. probably the most influential anime on me when I was in high school was Megazone 2-3. And these days, people look back at Megazone 2-3. I mean, first of all, it's very 80s. I mean, it's 85. It's smack in the middle of the 80s. You can't get more 80s than that. You look at the hair in there, like Shogo Yahagi's hair. That's almost accurate. People almost had hair like that. You know, it's they're just exaggerating a little bit for effect. But that anime made me want to go to Japan. And, you know, there have been a lot of jokes over the years, like Pipochu and Otaku no Theo and all that, about people who get this idea about Japan that it's a paradise for otaku, a paradise for anime fans. I wasn't looking at it that way. Megazone 2-3 made Tokyo look like the most exciting place to be young, to be a teenager. And again, this goes back to the fact that Japan was, in the 80s, Japan was the wave of the future. You know, people were turning Japanese. You know, you were big in Japan. There were songs, you know, those titles. I wanted to go over there. And Megazone 2-3, as you might know, is they went to a great deal of effort to have it be set in what looks like the actual Tokyo. Everything in there is an actual street, an actual store, an actual avenue. They're all real neighborhoods. And I wanted to go to those places. And when I went over there in 87, I did. I did go to Studio Alta. I did hang out at Cafe du Rope. And these were places I'd seen in Megazone 2-3. I mean, sure, the transforming mecha were cool and the science fiction were cool, but I wasn't really looking at it from that perspective. Megazone 2-3 was this romantic anime. You know, it's like, as previous generations, like, I want to go to London, like in the 60s, or previous people, like, I want to go to Paris in the 20s. It's like, I want to go to Tokyo in the 1980s. And that's how I felt. So years later, I met the seiyu for the female lead in Megazone 2-3, Maria Kawamura. She's played people like Jungfreud in Gunbuster, and she played Asuka's mom in Evangelion. And I met her at a Gainax party, and I said to her, "Hey, I've always wanted to thank you for what your work in Megazone 2-3. That work made me so like happy when I was a kid. I wish young people today in Japan had an anime like that that really spoke to them, that really talked about what it's like to be a young person in Japan today." She said, "Oh, there is. It's called Evangelion." So, oh.
That explains so much.
Right. So, but yeah, the funny thing was, I wasn't really a fan of Gainax per se. I was a fan of Royal Space Force, and like, I really loved that movie. And then Gunbuster came out in 1988. So it came to my local anime club, which at the time was Foothill. At Foothill College, those are the guys who started FanimeCon, by the way. As you know, so many conventions got started by local, you know, fan clubs. Mm. But anyway, so it came in, and the first thing I hear is, "Hey, you know, this is, you got to see this. This is the new anime by the studio who made Wings of Onyamas." And, "Oh my God, I got to see it. I got to see it." So I'm watching it, and like, you know, it's like, you know, is this like a joke? You know, it's like you watch the first episodes of Gunbuster and you never guess in a million years it was the same people who made Royal Space Force. So like it was such a, I was taking it far too seriously. You know, I was like a straight edge kid. You know, I don't mean, I was literally listening to 7 Seconds and all that, you know, and not wearing leather and so forth. But, you know, there was like, you know, it's 1988, and I'm saying it's 1988 and anime is going to hell. You know, look at all this crap. You know, anime is totally dead. You know, and our local club newsletter was like having a fan letter. It was coming out in 1988, and it said, "Are the anime boom years over?" You know, there have been anime booms and falls before. There was a big surge of OAVs and television shows in the mid-80s, and then it declined for a while. So basically, I kind of tuned it out. And then Nadia, like I said, "What's this? This is like, you know, where are these guys going?" And I didn't really develop a sense of Gainax until I saw something called Otaku no Video. And I'd never heard the word otaku before. I guess most people hadn't. And the guys, Seishun Shitemas, they were a fan dubbing group down in San Diego. These are the guys who founded J-List, the company. Great bunch of guys, and they were showing Otaku no Video in a room party. It was like Anime Expo 92. And I was watching it, and I was thinking to myself, hey, I did that. Oh, I do that stuff. But what's that word again? Otaku? Oh, I guess it's what I am. And then like, oh, these are the guys who made Rail Space Force? Oh, Otaku made Rail Space Force? Oh, wow. So I was kind of coming at it from the perspective of like, oh, Otaku made Rail Space Force, so Otaku can do that. Like, I was saying, oh, they're capable of this. Mm. And suddenly, like, everything kind of clicked into place, saying, oh, wow, these guys and all that. As you know, Gainax kind of got started to make Rail Space Force. It was the company wasn't supposed to last beyond that one film. It was just a sort of entity that's kind of come together as a one shot. And it was kind of a big surprise to everybody that they actually stuck together afterwards, you know, and made more films, especially since Rail Space Force didn't do too well at the box office. So that was what really got me on to Gainax as a fan and to start, you know, looking back at their other work and to, you know, to lighten up a little bit and to appreciate, you know, where they were coming from. As you know, Evangelion was the first anime they made after a 4-year hiatus after Otaku the Video. And it's kind of hard for people to understand today, but Evangelion at the time was seen as Gainax's comeback. You know, they just hadn't been around for a while. And there was this, nobody knew Evangelion was going to be so big. You know, it premiered on the smallest of Japan's, you know, major channels, you know, TV Tokyo. Most people didn't get a chance to see it the first time around. And it just sort of came out of nowhere. And this kind of underlies one of the biggest differences between Evangelion today and Evangelion back then, that this is so obvious it's kind of hard to state, but when Evangelion started, there was no Evangelion phenomenon. You see what I'm saying? It's like the first time they did it, it wasn't this famous thing. No one knew it was going to be famous. And that totally, you know, colored people's reaction to it. Today, it's something that everybody accepts. And everybody knows Evangelion in Japan. When I go to Japan, I like to go to Lawson's. You know Lawson's?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, Lawson's is this convenience store chain in Japan. It's like 7-Eleven or Family Mart. But one reason I like to go in there is that's every person goes in there. That's where you find what ordinary Japanese people are into, not otaku. They have a very limited selection of like manga and anything anime related. So what are you going to find in there? You're going to find stuff like One Piece, and you'll find like ads for Evangelion.
Right.
So, you know, that's when you kind of know it arrived. Getting back to Animerica magazine, as I said, even though we were an American magazine, we really tried as hard as we can. We tried as hard as we could to be on top of the news from Japan. And because there wasn't much news on the internet in those days, it was possible to kind of get exclusives. And we actually ran the first article on Evangelion. As far as I know, it was the first article period on Evangelion. We even scooped the Japanese magazines. And this ran in February of 1995. The series premiered in October of 95. If you go back and read that article, it actually describes a somewhat different series than was actually made, because what we heard about at the time was different from what actually happened. There was this kind of, first we heard it was going to be like Childhood's End by Arthur C. Clarke, that basically these alien-like being, the angels, are going to come down to Earth and warn humanity to stop experimenting with biotechnology. And that basically, like, this is your last warning and we're going to come back and check on you. And then humanity has like 15 years to kind of arm itself, knowing that these angels are going to come back. So whereas that idea ended up in the actual series, the idea of a first appearance of the angels, that is to say the so-called second impact, and then the angels return 15 years later, that whole idea of like them warning Earth, you know, got left out. But again, it was very exciting, and we're just saying, oh, hey, Gainax is back. You know, you remember Gainax, those guys who made, you know, Gunbuster and Otaku no Video. So, those were very interesting times. Mamoru Oshii was in the U.S. at the time in 95 to oversee the dubbing of Ghost in the Shell. He was down in Los Angeles, at the post-production. And, I went down there and interviewed him. He was talking about how, so to get back to 95, what was happening in Japan, this was a very tumultuous year in Japan. We're talking about the aftermath of the Kobe earthquake, which killed about 6,000 people. Also, the notorious cult group Om Shinrikyo attacked the Tokyo subway system with nerve gas and killed about 14 people. They had meant to kill many more. They actually timed their attack. This is like something out of Pat Labor. They timed their attack to wipe out the entire morning shift of the Tokyo Metropolitan Police Unit. The gas was supposed to go off as all of them were commuting to work on the subway. These guys, fortunately, were kind of amateurish, and it only killed, you know, a certain number of people. But needless to say, nerve gas in the subway, you know, top story in the evening news. And when I talked to Mamoru Oshii, he said the Tokyo police actually interviewed him after that. Because if you have seen Pat Labor 2 by Mamoru Oshii, which is one of the great anime films that came out in 93, one of the things that happens in the film is a gas attack in Tokyo. Now, the gas attack is a harmless gas. It's sort of done as a warning. But they kind of interviewed him because they wanted to know if he had any connection with Om Shinrikyo or whether they were getting, you know, any ideas from him and so forth. So he said that, you know, he was kind of getting the feeling that he was kind of a prophet in that film. But he didn't think that people in Japan were going to wake up to what he was saying, that basically Japan was not this safe country that everybody thought it was, that there were these kind of, you know, dark undercurrents, you know, running in it and people with these schemes. And one day it was just going to, you know, explode in people's faces. You guys ever seen like Armitage the Third? Okay. Well, one of the weird things back then, Pioneer Laserdisc Corporation was releasing Armitage. And again, this is Laserdisc, which is now kind of a defunct format. But all through the 80s and 90s, the prestige format for anime fans was the Laserdisc. It was a 12-inch wide disc. It looks like a DVD, but it was an analog format. And Pioneer, of course, who were kind of masters of Laserdisc technology, they put out the highest quality U.S. releases. They had these very nice U.S. LD anime releases with, like, fully translated liner notes and so forth. But when Armitage, there's this anime called Armitage the Third, and when it first came out in the U.S., it was dub only. And this is their way of kind of promoting it to get it to a wider audience. And the male lead in Armitage was played by a guy named Kiefer Sutherland. And I went down to interview Kiefer Sutherland, or at least that's what I thought I was doing. So I went down to the studio and, like, I think it was in Venice. And Venice, California, obviously not the one in Italy. So I went down there and I'm waiting in the studio, and I see Kiefer Sutherland through the glass in the studio. I'd heard about chain smoking before, but I never met anyone who actually chain smoked. So he literally never stopped smoking. So he'd have the cigarette in his mouth and it would burn down to just the butt. Okay, so just the glowing tip. And then he'd take another cigarette out, touch it to the glowing butt, and then throw the butt away and threw the next one in his mouth. So that's what they mean by chain smoking. It's a continuous chain.
Right.
That's why he's got that voice. So I'm seeing him there, and like, I'm getting really hyped up for my interview. I got this little tiny pearl quarter I'm going to talk to him with. But these, you know, these reps come out. I think they're from Pioneer. They're like the guys from Pharmacon and Johnny Mnemonic, you know? And like, it's like, sorry, kid, you know, Mr. Sutherland's, you know, tired. You can't do the interview. And like, I'd driven down there from, like, you know, the Bay Area and all that in a Ford Probe. But the, so it looks like after all that, I'm going to miss it. Then suddenly Kiefer Sutherland comes out and like, he's like totally cool, totally chill. And says, hey, aren't you from that magazine? Oh, right. You know, I'm going to give you an interview and all that. And the Pioneer reps like kind of, they don't want this to happen. And they kind of edge towards him. And they kind of edge back and they edge towards him and they edge back because they don't want to like offend their star, but they don't want to give me the interview either. And so Kiefer kind of saved the day there, kind of sat down on the stairs and started talking. And he's a really nice guy. Like none of this, like I'm a Hollywood actor and you're not. And he didn't know too much about anime. We talked about his dad who had just been in The Simpsons, Donald Sutherland, in a recent role. We talked about the difference between dubbing anime and doing The Simpsons. One of the big differences being The Simpsons, you do the voices first. You know, and then they do the animation. Kiefer Sutherland talked about growing up watching Kimba and all that. And But again, that was kind of the, you know, an example of encouragement and kind of an early sign that, you know, anime could kind of go places and, you know, could be accepted by people. So I think maybe there was a lot of opportunity back then simply because the industry was young and not as many people knew about anime, so that people hadn't kind of solidified their opinions of it yet. That's kind of a strange way of putting it. But, you know, I think about being 16 and going into studios in Japan. I don't think you could do that today. It's like, because, you know, it's more developed now and people have more of a sense of, you know, of what they want out of things.
Right. So, I mean, so this was during your years at Animerica as a journalist.
Right.
And they had this big initiative to interview all these people. Those were sort of, I think most people who have at least some sense of history look at those specific years at Animerica as sort of the golden years of that magazine. You know, eventually, you know, say what you will about it, it became pretty much like every other anime magazine, which was features and, you know, here's what's coming up and here's our review of this thing that gets 3.5 ninja stars out of 5. You know, which is fine. Hell, I worked for Anime Insider. That's what we did there, except we weren't allowed to have an opinion on anything. Those were those years. Eventually, you transitioned over into being a manga editor as a full-time gig. You started Dark Horse in 2004?
That's true, but I started as a manga editor at Viz.
Right.
The first manga I edited was, big surprise, Neon Genesis Evangelion.
Uh-huh.
This was in 1997. There was a fierce bidding war over Evangelion. Viz tried to get the rights to it. Quickly, you know, shot up to stratospheric prices, or at least what were thought to be stratospheric prices for the 1990s.
Any idea what that number was?
The number we heard was that, and I'm sure, you know, Mr. Ledford and Mr. Greenfield can correct me on this, was $350,000.
Which for was, episode?
No, for the whole thing.
What?
So somebody is probably laughing somewhere, and maybe I'm, you know, misremembering it. That was a lot of money in 1995,
yeah.
You know, for an anime. You have got to remember how long ago this was. ADV had gotten, they'd won the bid before the show was even finished airing. So, you know, they really were on the ball about that. But it was known at Animerica that I was an Evangelion fan. And Trish Ledoux, again, who had brought me into Animerica in the first place, she's also the person who brought me into manga editing. And you have to start somewhere. So if you don't know anything about manga editing, at least you could know something about the title. So that's why it was Evangelion I started with. So she kind of mentored me on all that. The thing to understand about manga editing in the 90s, and this was true until about the beginning of the 2000s, was that for the first 15 years of manga being published in the U.S., let's say between 1987 and 2002, manga was published in comic book form. Manga was basically a subset of the U.S. comics industry because that's where people read comics. There wasn't this idea yet there was a separate manga readership. And it wasn't such a crazy idea because, remember, talking about guys like Frank Miller, who was really known as a big manga fan, and all these black and white American comics that came out in the 80s. The fact that people were reading black and white comics in the 80s made it acceptable to try to sell manga over here because, hey, maybe people will read it. You know, you don't have to have it in color. That gave it an opening. And in a way, it was a fairly natural way to release manga. And this is what I mean. A lot of manga, we know about magazines like Shonen Jump and so forth, which are weeklies in Japan. But a lot of manga magazines are monthly, you know, Afternoon is monthly, you know, where Blade of the Immortal is from and Oh My Goddess, you know, Shonen Ace, which is the home of Evangelion, is a monthly. So if you release one chapter a month in the U.S. as a comic book, say 24 pages a month, you're actually releasing it at the pace it was meant to be read in Japan. This whole idea of releasing manga straight to graphic novel, that's something they almost never do in Japan. You know, the manga gets serialized first. If you look at my office right now, and that's where I'm talking from, it's kind of like a human Tetris game. My office is full of manga magazines stacked almost literally to the ceiling. Nakayoshi, Flapper, Good Afternoon, Asuka, Young King R's Young Magazine you know, these are all the magazines that are constantly, you know, coming out in Japan, and that's where manga first appears, and that's what they're drawn for. So, and furthermore, if you've ever seen manga magazines, the page size, what we call the trim size in the industry, how big the page actually is, it's closer to the size of an American comic book than it is to a tankobon, you know, a graphic novel. So for those reasons, releasing it in comic book form seemed fairly natural. So the first seven volumes of Evangelion here all got released as comic book first, and then they got collected, you know, only afterwards into graphic novel format. Evangelion was also the first manga in the U.S. released in unflopped format. Today, unflopped format is kind of standard, but back then it was very controversial. It was thought that no one in the U.S. would buy a manga that you had to read Japanese style. I found out years later that Dark Horse had turned down Evangelion for that reason. They didn't think anyone would read it. And to be fair, Viz didn't think anyone would read it either. We actually asked Kadokawa, well, okay, if we have to release it unflopped, can we also release a flopped version? Because we don't think anyone's going to buy the unflopped version. And they said, well, if you want to do it twice, I guess. So we ended up releasing two versions at the same time, a flopped and unflopped version. And I'm having to edit both. So one I'm having to read right to left, the one left to right, you know, it's very confusing. I need a big like toggle switch in my head, you know, go A, B. What happened actually was that the sales ratio was for every three unflopped copies we sold five unflopped copies. So for every three Japanese-style ones we sold five Western-style. So people were buying it, and maybe we ended up selling more overall. But we called the Japanese edition the Special Collector's Edition. In other words, the only reason we could think of that people would want to buy a Japanese-style comic is it's collectors, right? Comics collectors? Mm-hmm. Like it's a variant cover, like it's Chromium or something. So, and again, like, this was not... Remember, this is a Japanese company, you know... back then it was a subsidiary of Shogakukan. You know, today it's, you know, Shogakukan, Shueisha, and other things. But Viz wasn't doing this because they were a bunch of Philistines who, like, didn't appreciate manga or Japanese culture. They had just been in the industry for 10 years at this point, and that was their sense of market conditions. There's no point in putting out a manga if you're going to do something where it's not going to sell. And you may remember for a while, last decade, there was almost these kind of wars of religion over flopping versus unflopping.
Yep.
And for a long time, it was thought that it was kind of settled that, okay, from now on, all manga are going to be unflopped as a total abomination to ever flop it. And you know what? Today, they're more flopped manga than ever before. You go back, you look at like what Drawn and Quarterly is doing. You look at what Vertical is doing. You know, you're seeing books coming out there that are flopped, and they're reaching audiences. I think Ed Chavez mentioned that the only reason that they didn't flop Drops of God was because it's got all those wine labels and they'd be a real pain to redraw. So naturally, you know, if you flop something, maybe I should explain this whole flopping thing. Okay. So, you know, here in the West, we read, let me remember, how do we read? Oh yeah. Left to right. So that's a direction we read. Pick up a American book, pick up an American magazine, and it reads the opposite way from a Japanese, right? So by flopping it, that just means you photo reverse it. These days, that's easy to do in any program. You just flip it like it was in a mirror. But one of the consequences of that is, suppose the mangaka drew a sign or something, or as a label, well, then that's all flipped too. So you have to redraw the text and so forth. You know, it's a real pain. If there's like a logo, like someone's, Oh My Goddess is full of like bike logos, Honda, Mitsubishi, I mean, Kawasaki and all that. Those all have to be redrawn. So in a way, it was great to get away from the whole flopping and flopping thing. But I know it's just the most fascinating issue of our time. You can tell I'm a manga editor, right? Okay, so back to the history of manga. So I started with Evangelion. In 99, 2000 or so, I got involved with a magazine called Pulp. Mm-hmm. This is also at Viz.
Yep.
Probably one of the hardest genres, or I should say demographics, of manga to sell in the U.S. has been seinen manga. It's not as hard as it used to be. And one of the problems is that seinen is kind of this really vague term. Seinen includes everything from Golgo 13 to Azumanga Daioh. It's like, it doesn't really tell you all that much.
Right.
And to be perfectly honest, in Japan, these terms don't mean all that much either. People just like to be able to break things down into categories. But people in Japan are, the people in the Japanese industry are perfectly aware of how vague terms like shonen and seinen are. But pulp was basically trying to sell manga that were for mature readers, manga that were not going to be censored, but also experimental manga. These were titles like Voyeur's Ink, Dance Till Tomorrow by Naoki Yamamoto, Bakana Young, Banana Fish, which is actually a very famous shoujo title. But it was real. It was a real kind of grab bag. And it kind of illustrated one of the problems of making manga anthology magazines work in this country. Now, I got back to how my office is stacked full of manga anthology magazines and how that's the natural format of manga in Japan. But there are two things that really make a manga anthology magazine work. You have to give people a lot of pages for little money. Now, technically, magazines like Pulp were a good deal. They give you like 200 pages for like $6. But in order to feel that's a good deal, you have to like break out your calculator and work it out. It has to be such a good deal that you don't bother to think about it. And that's why the manga magazine didn't really succeed until you had stuff like Shonen Jump, which really was offering these tremendous deals. You know, Yen Plus offered, you know, a great deal as well. You know, and they, of course, have had their own, you know, difficulties over the years and, you know, transitioning to digital and so forth. But they had years of, you know, tremendous success. So Pulp was kind of ahead of its time, I guess. And we were just trying to, I was kind of continuing what I did for the Animerica for Pulp, because Pulp had a lot of articles. And basically Pulp was a bunch of like 20-somethings and, you know, getting into your 30s. We wanted to write articles about anime and manga for people our age. It's like, we're not, you know, there's nothing wrong with being a teenager, because that's when I got into anime. That's when I got into manga. But I'm not that age anymore, and it'd be kind of phony for me to like try to, you know, hey man, the kids, I understand you totally and all that, you know.
Right.
You know, better try to speak to people, you know, my own age. And so we were trying to write about anime and manga in a kind of uncensored fashion, you know, a lot of swear words, you know, talking about sex, you know, and basically having uncensored manga. And you know, it was kind of a cool magazine, and this was kind of the incubator of people like Jason Thompson, Patrick Macias, really brilliant designer named Izumi Evers, who was really behind the whole Pulp line. Izumi was doing like all the stuff years before everyone else was like branding their manga and like having uniform logo schemes and, you know, having the spine constructed just so. Izumi was the first person to do all that. And she really started that with the Pulp line. At the same time, there was a manga called Eagle that came out. Eagle was a manga about, okay, this is really unbelievable manga. Here's the plot line. A U.S. senator who's a minority challenges Hillary Clinton for the Democratic nomination for president. And then he runs against a Republican who's a Air Force veteran of Vietnam for the presidency. Now, that can never happen in the U.S.
No, that's totally fantasy. Yeah.
Like, just goes to show those Japanese, you know. So Eagle was by Kaiji Kawaguchi, who is maybe most famous for Zipong, which is that alternate history manga about a Japanese maritime self-defense force, which time slips back to World War II. He did a very famous manga series in the 1980s called The Silent Service. But Eagle was about the U.S. presidential process. And why this was so fascinating for manga readers in Japan is they really have nothing like it in Japan. Japanese politics is very boring compared to U.S. politics. If you've ever wondered if there's a country where fewer people vote than America, yes, there is such a country. It's called Japan, believe it or not. And people over there are very cynical about the process. And suddenly in 1999, with the U.S. election coming out, we decided to release it. And this was coming out in a new format. We were releasing it sort of half a tankobon at a time. 100 pages a month, which was a pace that no one had ever released manga in the U.S. before. Dark Horse is going to start doing this a year later with Lone Wolf and Cub in 2000. But we did these experimental covers. I actually got licensed footage from CNN. What I would do is I would look at each Tankobon and say, okay, what's going on in this volume? Okay, they're going to Super Tuesday. So I would contact CNN, and CNN has this whole archive department. And I'd say, I talked to the people there and say, can you give me some Super Tuesday footage? And they'd say, sure, here's a list of what we got. We have like McCain appearing here. We have like Bill Bradley appearing there. And I'd say, okay, give me this and that. And they'd send me a VHS tape, and it'd be like, say, $300 for the footage. So it'd be licensed, and then Izumi would make this kind of photo composite cover. And we were doing this to kind of get non-manga readers into it and to kind of give the idea that this is something for everybody. Because, I mean, after all, it's about the U.S. presidential race, so you'll never get a better chance to sort of have a manga that Americans can relate to. I remember one of the reviewers thought that an unrealistic thing about the manga, this is not a spoiler because they reveal it in the very first, volume. There are two main characters in the manga, one of whom is Senator Yamaoka, who's a Japanese-American senator, third generation. The other guy is a reporter from Okinawa, and Takashi Joe. And the senator is actually Takashi Joe's dad. When he was on his way to Vietnam, he had a stopover in Okinawa back in the late 60s, early 70s, and he had a brief affair with the guy's mom. And the mom never told her son who the dad was, let alone that he was a U.S. senator and running for president. And so years later, the son gets invited to Washington to cover this race. And he's really amazed because he's just a local reporter. He doesn't know anything about international politics. Why was he selected? And so the senator invites him into his room and says, son, I am your father. And not only is this a big bombshell, but why did he tell him that? Because he could destroy his campaign right now. All the son has to do is like report this, and this guy's presidential race is over. It's finished. The dad is playing some kind of psychological mind game with his son because he knows on son level, his son, he needs the father. I mean, he's always wanted to know who his father was. And oh my God, not only has he finally met his father could become the president of the United States. But like many people feel about abandoned dads, he also kind of hates the guy. And he's not sure this guy really deserves to be president. He's kind of a monster in some ways. So one of the reviewers, I think it was in the Washington Post maybe, said, you can never keep this secret in Washington. Nobody in Washington could ever like keep a secret kid like that. It would have come out years ago. So a few years back, there was this famous senator named Strom Thurmond. he was a notorious racist, segregationist. He ran for president in 1948, basically on a anti-black platform. So he dies, right? And he's in his 90s. And it turns out this guy had a black daughter all these years.
Yeah.
The guy was so old, his daughter was like in his 70s. So yes, he had kept that secret all these years, you know. And, you know, one of the ideas in Eagle is that racism in America, a large part of the power of racism in America is because people will not look at the obvious. And the obvious is that we're all mixed together. Like, people deny the fact that, you know, this country is mixed up of all ethnicities. They want to have this kind of purity that, like, never really existed. I think about President Obama, and one of the strange things about him, you know, is it's unusual. He's a fairly young man for a president. Usually when a guy becomes president, at least one of their parents are alive, right? But both his parents died a long time ago. And, you know, as everybody knows, his mother was white and his dad was black. And I've often wondered what it would be like if he were president and his parents were still around and people could see that. And I kind of wish people could see that to sort of say,
we have fewer truthers.
But also what I mean is that's the truth about America. That's the truth right there. You know, it goes back to Thomas Jefferson, you know, who had black children, but he couldn't acknowledge them. You know, they were slaves. I mean, imagine being one child of Thomas Jefferson and you're like, you're all honored and all that. Hey, Thomas Jefferson's my dad. And you're another child and you're a slave. Why? Because your mother was black. That's like the tragedy of America right there. if he just could have had the guts to say, you know what, they're all my children. We could have saved this country a lot of trouble. You know, we could have, you know, I mean, I know that's asking too much of like our history, but,
right.
But that's kind of the idea of one of the ideas of looking at racism in Eagle, that the reason we have racism so much is that we just won't admit that we're all a mix. And that is America. And not only are we a mix, we're constantly mixing. That mix is always changing. Every time some new ethnic group comes to the fore in America, it's like, oh, the Irish are coming in. Oh, my God, it's the end of America. The Irish are coming in. The Italians are coming in. Oh, my God, it's the end of America. It's the Italians. You know, every group gets that. And then once they get accepted in America, they tend to forget where they came from. Then they look at the next group that's coming in, you know, be it Mexicans or Asians, and say, oh, no, those guys are going to ruin America. And they forget the exact same things were said about them back in the day, the exact same things, you know.
Right.
You know, you're talking about Obama and people think he's a Muslim. You know, what if they think people think he's just say about Catholics, you know?
And that was a big deal for JFK.
People talk about Judeo-Christian values in America as if Jews and Christians were all treated alike. Even all Christians weren't treated alike. It used to make a big difference in this country whether you're Catholic or Protestant. You know, and what do they say about Catholics? That they weren't loyal to America, that they were taking orders from the Pope,
yeah.
That they would do anything their religion told them to. Does that sound familiar? You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, if we're going to make this country work as America, we have to trust that people are going to want to become Americans and are going to want to integrate and accept the American way. Because I'm not saying that out of naivete. That's how we're going to rise or fall as a nation. That's how we've always risen or fall as a nation. You know, we can't change our course now. We have to trust, you know, in that American idea. A little while back, you know, The Economist magazine? I don't know if they ever cite ANN, but like...
I don't think so. I know the magazine, but yeah.
They were talking about how popular Pokemon was in America. And there's this idea sometimes, there's a stereotype of Americans that Americans don't like anything that isn't American and that we won't accept anything from another culture. And they were saying stuff like Pokemon kind of proves that's not true. You know, I was at Viz, visited the Pokemon manga. The Pokemon manga sold 1 million copies. It was gigantic. It was a tremendous boom. And a lot of people did not think Pokemon was going to succeed in this country. Not everybody involved that thought it was going to succeed. Why didn't they think it was going to succeed? Because it looked cheap. Because it's this weird thing. I'm not saying these are what the naysayers were saying. So they said, hey, these are American kids. They've grown up with Steven Spielberg. They've grown up with the most sophisticated special effects on Earth. They're not going to like Pokemon. It was the same people who said they're not going to like Power Rangers. And they kind of forgot about one thing about kids that kids have. Kids have imagination. And you looked at Pokemon, and Pokemon is so full of like weird, wonderful, like creative ideas or just, you know, stuff that, you know, people would never come up with in this country. They'd get committed to death, you know. So, you know, there's for a while at Viz, there's a lot of talk about looking for the next Mon, you know. What's the next Mon going to be? Is going to be Doraemon, maybe, you know. Mm. Doraemon never really, of course, took off in this country. It's kind of popular in Latin America. I just don't think it's wild enough. But so anyway, yeah, I went to Dark Horse in 2004. I mentioned Torrin Smith back then. Torrin Smith is kind of one of my senpai. He was the founder of Studio Proteus, which were one of the first people to bring manga to the U.S.
Yeah.
And he also was one of the pioneers of video room anime presentation. I talked about how in 87 and 88, there were hardly any fan subs and so forth. So when you're going to watch anime, how are you going to understand what's going on? And the way people did it is they would publish guidebooks. So somebody who'd seen it and somebody who knew some Japanese would write a little article about it, a short article, you know, maybe 500, 600 words, which would give you the synopsis of the plot and mention the main characters, you know, put in like line art and so forth, and would Xerox this and so forth. And you would kind of read it as you would watch the anime. I know the room's kind of dark, but you know, you wouldn't try to read too far ahead in case there were spoilers, but it was better than nothing, right? And it would help you understand the anime. Mm-hmm. Well, Torrin was doing these really sophisticated books, and this is 1986. the Mac and a desktop publishing were kind of in its infancy, but he was already using this technology. And back then, there weren't any anime cons per se. What you would do, I mentioned how I discovered anime in 1982 at a gaming con. So what you do is you'd go to a gaming con, you go to a science fiction convention, and you'd say, can I put on an anime room? And that's how you do it. The big science fiction convention in the Bay Area was called, very creatively, BayCon. And not only did Torin run an anime room there, but what he would do is he would make these trailers for the anime. He'd like show like maybe 60 seconds of the car chase from the Castle Cagliostro. And then he'd have like a board where he'd written Castle Cagliostro, the name, and he'd like train a video camera on it and show it. And then he'd like show like 60 seconds of the Macross movie and do the same thing. And so he had it on a loop. And he put this loop, VCR and a TV, and he put it right outside the dealer's room at BayCon. So everybody going in or out would see it. And pretty soon the dealer's room was completely empty and everybody was going to the anime room. This is 1986. It was a tremendously exciting time for anime. Robotech had been on the air. And this is just the right time to get people into anime because people were watching Robotech. And one of the great things about living in the San Francisco area is that Robotech was actually on after school. And in many parts of the country, Robotech was on before school. And obviously, if you have to watch Robotech at 6 in the morning, a lot fewer people are going to watch it. But if it's on at, say, 3:30 or 4, you know, people are going to tune in. And if you're talking to people at school about anime and they say, oh, what is this anime stuff? You can just say, turn on the TV after school, check out that Robotech, you know, it's like that. So once you saw Robotech, people were saying, what's next? And you're saying, what's next? Well, what's next is the Macross movie. What's next is Castle in the Sky, Laputa, Nausicaa, you know, Castle Cagliostro. There's all this stuff to catch up on. I think kind of my anime watching habits were formed back then. Back then, there was not this idea that you had to be necessarily watching the anime that's on TV right now, because you couldn't do it. There was no practical way that you were going to be watching what's on anime right now this season, you know, let alone this week or, you know, this hour. You probably at best are going to be a few months behind Japan. Somebody was going to have to like record it in Japan, some pen pal, and someone was going to have to send it from overseas, and you probably get a second or third, you know, generation copy. But that was fine. I mean, any bit of anime was like, you know, precious. So I kind of developed that habit to this day. I don't really worry about the fact that I may not be watching what's on right now. You know, you guys are talking about Bodacious Space Pirates, how it's a really good show. And definitely I'm going to check that out. But I'm probably not going to see it for a while. You know, I'm going to, you know, get around to it. So anyway, but Torin was retiring from manga. And he kind of suggested that maybe I could take over at Dark Horse because he had been doing all their manga stuff for them. So on his recommendation, I went up there. And I've been working at Dark Horse since 2004. And Dark Horse is a different kind of company. The biggest difference between Dark Horse and Viz, of course, is that Dark Horse publishes a lot of original comics. We've done some fairly famous books like Hellboy, Sin City, 300, The Goon, mm-hmm. Usagi Yojimbo. And so here I'm the only person at Dark Horse who only specializes in manga. There are some other people here who also work on manga, like Chris Warner and Philip Simon and Jamia Jefferson. But I'm the only person who only does manga. But the people I get to work with all the time, it's fascinating because, you know, they're working on comics. And in a way, they're closer to being what manga editors are in Japan. Of course, a manga editor in Japan is someone who has to actually make it from scratch, right? They have to get a writer together, get an artist together, get it all scheduled. So these guys are doing that here all the time, and I'm kind of in awe of that because, you know, that's quite a feat. It helps us out also when we're talking with the Japanese publishers because, you know, Dark Horse manga are published in Japan too. There are Japanese versions of 300. By the way, the Spartans in 300, they end like all their sentences with Zol. So that's how Spartans talk in Japanese. There's Japanese editions of Sin City. There's Japanese editions of Hellboy. So in a sense, that kind of demystifies the process. So we do English versions of Japanese manga, but they do Japanese versions of our stuff. And our stuff has been published in many languages. We want our stuff to look good in Japanese, to have a nice edition and all that. So whenever we look at a manga, it's never just like a commodity to us. It didn't come from some magic, you know, manga land. Every time we look at a manga, we can see the blank page it started as. We know that someone had to sit down and draw this and ink it and write it and edit it, because we do the same things ourselves all the time with comics. So that's why we try to take special care with our work, you know, and look at it from that perspective. We kind of, in a way, view manga as a form of comics because we publish comics from all over the world. Dark Horse has been publishing comics since 1986, but we've been publishing manga since 1988. That was just 1 year after Viz. We're the second oldest continuous publisher of manga in the United States. We wanted to publish manga from the very beginning. We wanted to start off with Lone Wolf and Cub, but we lost off with that, lost out with that. Eventually we did, you know, pick it up later and finish the series. Mm-hmm. But the point is that we always wanted to publish manga. And so we sort of view it all as like kind of everybody should be good into good comics everywhere. It doesn't matter whether they come from Europe or Brazil or Japan or the US. Right now I'm working on an ad for the Kurosagi Corpse Delivery Service that's going to appear in Eerie. Eerie is a famous horror anthology that was a black and white magazine back in the 60s and 70s. We've revived the title. But as it might suggest, Eerie is in horror anthology. They're basically these modern tales of horror with a kind of, you know, humorous, sardonic twist. And Kurosagi fits in right in with that. You know, like we do the Conan comics, right? Mm-hmm. I think if you like Conan, you should at least give Berserk a try.
Yeah, no kidding.
If you like Conan, you should give Katsuya Terada's The Monkey King a try. You know, if you like guys like Rich Corbin or Eric Powell, who does The Goon, who have this kind of, you know, beautiful painted but kind of, you know, weird horror style, you know, Katsuya Terada might be the guy for you. So, you know, if you like Buffy, we do plenty of vampire manga. So, yeah, I mean, there's no reason why people should just limit themselves to one form of comic. And that's one of the wonderful things about working about here, that you get constantly exposed to these different currents.
Well, it also sounds like there's a little bit of a through line here, because, you know, you talked about, you know, as your years at Viz went on, you worked on pulp, which, you know, most people, Justin and I have been around long enough to remember pulp. You know, that was seinen material. And Dark Horse is known for publishing mostly seinen material. And very, you know, high-quality seinen material. And, you know, there's sort of a through line there. It also sounds like the titles that you select at Dark Horse for publishing complement everything else the company's already releasing. It doesn't feel like a weird fit. It feels like, okay, I could see Dark Horse putting this out because it's sort of complementary to their other stuff.
Well, when we started doing our Clamp books, what did you think?
Well, okay, that's the exception. That one, I think that just makes good business sense.
Did you know that we wanted to do Fruits Basket?
No. Maybe that's up for grabs now. So.
No, I mean back when before it was published the first time.
Oh, okay. No.
No, I mean we. It's true that we have that kind of. I think the reason people think that about Dark Horse is, seinen is the default demographic of American comics, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you think of the typical American comic reader, you probably think of a 20, 30-year-old guy. Now, that by no means represents the totality of American comics or the reality of all comics readers, not at all. That is probably people's typical image of it. Whereas in Japan, you know, manga readership is more evenly divided. Even Shonen Jump, which is ostensibly shonen, you know, boys, as many girls read that, you know, as guys do. So, you know, a lot of people here are fans of shoujo manga. And it's true that part of the reason we work with Clamp is a kind of Dark Horse type reason. And a Dark Horse type reason is working directly with artists. So we, when we're doing our versions of the Clamp omnibus books, some of them look better than they ever have before. That's because Clamp does their best to try to hold on to all their original art. So for example, when you look at our versions of Cardcaptor Sakura, they actually took their original art out of their vault, and they actually have a vault. It's climate controlled, like thumbprints, You know, I think there's like two keys you got to turn. It's like War Games, you know.
Mm, right.
Turn your key, sir. Mm-hmm. The so they actually took the original art for Cardcaptor Sakura out of storage and scanned it at very high resolution. And that's why it looks so much crisper than any version before. Some of the earlier versions of Clamp that got published here, they just took the Tonkobon, and you know how it is. You pop it in the microwave for a few minutes. That loosens the glue. Then you can scan the pages. That's right. How it's done.
Yeah.
But, you know, and then you release a version of that, but anybody could do that.
And
you know
do.
What I'm saying? And they do. But, like, here's the way I look at it. If we're asking people to buy the licensed, authorized edition of the manga, shouldn't we do our best to offer them higher quality than they can get themselves? It's like, you could have just scanned it yourself, you know? You should get something better than that. So it's not always possible to get high quality materials from Japan for various reasons, but we always try our best to do so. And we don't mind paying to do so. You know, there's a fee, of course, involved because they've got to do the work and scan it and all that. But we don't mind paying that either. Because, again, like, we want our books to look good, right? We want our American Dark Horse books to look good. Why should we lowball the Japanese books? They're all going to have the Dark Horse label on it. So, yeah, I mean, another thing also kind of that is seinen but isn't really seinen is Oh My Goddess, of course.
Right.
Yeah. And Oh My Goddess dates to some of the earliest days of Dark Horse manga. This, again, is like how problematic the title Oh My Goddess is. And I've had to explain to a lot of people that Oh My Goddess is supposed to be for guys. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of people here do not believe that. And that just shows, like, how American perceptions of things can be different, you know, from... You know, I show the Shinji Ikari Raising Project to people, and they don't believe it's for guys, you know?
Yeah.
But Oh My Goddess, as I'm endlessly saying, because it's true, is the longest-running manga in English. It's been running continuously since 1994.
Jesus.
And that's because fans have supported it for all those years. But when Oh My Goddess first came out in 94, it was a somewhat controversial title. And you say, Oh My Goddess, like, what's controversial about that? It's controversial because people's heads weren't exploding, because guts weren't flying out, because, you know, people weren't getting their heads chopped off. What kind of manga is this? It's a bunch of people sitting around having tea. Like, you know, it was basically a relationship, a love comedy before that was an accepted genre for manga. You know, rom-com, that's a thing these days. You know, it was before things like Love Hina and all that kind of, you know, set the template. But Torrin Smith, whose idea it was to do Oh My Goddess, he understood that fans wanted this sort of thing as well. That, yes, fans wanted the action and the violence and all that kind of stuff. They wanted Ghost in the Shell. They wanted Akira. But there's a lot of fans who also wanted a story about empathy, about kindness, about love. And that's been the staying power of this series. There is I get a wider range of letters for Oh My Goddess than I've ever gotten for anything. I've gotten letters from 9-year-old fans, and I've gotten letters from professors of neuropharmacology. Oh, this professor of neuropharmacology dude, he's at a Canadian university. And he said, hey, can you help us get Kosuke Fujishima come and talk at our college? And I'm thinking, I'll bet this guy means Masamune Shiro. Neuropharmacology, right? That sounds Ghost in the Shell. I'll bet he's confused. I'll bet he's got the wrong name. No. He meant Kosuke Fujishima. See, he specializes in the rehabilitation of people with nerve injuries. And it turned out that reading Oh My Goddess was helping the therapeutic program.
Hmm.
And then he sends me his fanfic.
No.
And he has to send it to me because it's a self-published book. He wrote this whole book about Erd. This is a guy with a PhD, you know, highly advanced scientific field, you know, a lot of credits and all that. And he's writing fan fiction. And I thought, I am never again going to make assumptions about fan fiction. You know what? It's not just people, you know, in their basement and all that. It's not just some kid. You know, there's some highly educated people out there writing it.
Yeah.
But I've gotten letters from people who, okay, someone who married someone from another country, so they had to get a visa to come in, a kind of green card so they could get married. And they met through Oh My Goddess, through our letters column. And they showed the INS agents the letters that appeared in Oh My Goddess as evidence to the fact they had a real relationship. So I got a letter from a girl who started reading Oh My Goddess when she was 16 in 1994, when it first started coming out. Now she's a mother and has three children, and she's still reading Oh My Goddess. And so that's just amazing to me. It's like this series, I mean, it's true that, you know, Belle Dandy and Keiichi never really do anything, you know, even holding hands is a big event for them.
For 15 years.
For 23 years in Japan.
Oh my God.
But it's got something. And the other day I got a first letter from a Japanese reader. It turned out that he'd seen Oh My Goddess in Kinokuniya in Tokyo in the foreign language section. And he thought, oh, this is cool. And so he wrote in. It turns out he's a high school student. And I thought, wait a minute. You're a high school student. You're reading Oh My Goddess? Oh My Goddess started before you were born. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that doesn't mean there's no reason you can't read it, because a lot of people. But I was curious. And I said, hey, like, don't you think it looks strange? What do you think about the old 80s style and all that? Like, so no. I love Oh My Goddess. Lots of people here like it. So I'm kind of. There's a lot of merit to being able to work on a series that has lasted so long and has such a diversity of fans. Because if you're a manga fan, and I am, it's great to be able to see manga as it is. I mean, you have ambitions for manga, and you want it to be able to do this and to do that. But it's also great to be able to learn about it as people actually experience, what people are actually reading, what fans actually like, and what they really think about it. That's the reality of manga. Manga is far too vast for any person to impose their ideas about it, their theories about it, and so forth. There's nobody even in Japan who like understands, you know, the whole thing. It's just this huge field. That's what's so great about it. So I brought Oh My Goddess up, of course, because you brought the whole issue of Dark Horse as a seinen company. And of course, we are the company of Gantz. We are the company of MPD Psycho. Mm-hmm. We are the company of the Kurosagi Corpse Delivery Service. But again, the weird thing is that we're doing Chobits, and Chobits is a seinen manga, technically. Mm-hmm. It ran the same magazine as Ghost in the Shell, after all, same magazine as Akira. A lot of people wouldn't believe that, but it's true. Shinji Ikari Raising Project runs in the same magazine as MPD Psycho. You know, Shonen is never meant as little as it does in Shonen Ace. But we are, we're constantly looking at all kinds of manga. And again, I think if we have a somewhat seinen reputation, it may be more due to the fact that we are a comics company, and comics in America are what you would call a seinen demographic in Japan.
Right. And you don't publish like a lot of shoujo. Like there's nothing to that.
No, we don't. And but again, like, we have absolutely no prejudice against it or anything of that sort.
Yeah, no, I don't think anyone thinks that. It's just, you know, it gets described that way because of what you publish, not necessarily because anyone thinks you're sort of adverse to other things or anything like that.
Well, it's weird because I'm working on Angelic Layer right now, this Clamp title.
Uh-huh.
And it's actually a shonen title. I mean, it runs in, what I mean is it's an old fashioned shonen title.
Yeah.
Because Misaki is this like totally hyper, pure hearted kid who like, she wants to fight, she wants to win clean, she wants to make friends with everybody. Those are real old fashioned shonen values. But, you know, people think of Clamp as, you know, a shoujo artist. And I guess another reason why Clamp is Dark Horse's type of manga creator is because Clamp has done so much crossover stuff themselves.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to say Clamp is like this or Clamp are like that is like that, it depends really heavily on which Clamp, you know, book you're talking about. So, you know, it's great because you never quite know what you're going to get from them next.
Yeah. Okay. So before we get to Twitter, so you said you're working on Angelic Layer. Any books coming? What's big for you this year in 2012? What can we look forward to?
Well, of course, we're finishing up Cardcaptor Sakura. Clamp has given us a whole bunch of bonus art for book four. So the previous ones have had a lot of color. This is going to have even more, I think like 41 color paintings. We're starting Angelic Layer. You know, we have five titles that we're going to be announcing, but we're not ready to announce them yet. Okay. I know it's like highly irritating.
That's all right. So I'm used to it.
You're going to hear at least five new titles from us and maybe more. There's five just that we know we're doing. In terms of new stuff starting out, Furikuri, you know, is coming out. Hmm. And that's going to have some material that wasn't in the original collection here. It's going to be a one-volume omnibus. We're also going to include the color in color. Yeah, most of our new stuff, unfortunately, I can't quite talk about yet.
That's okay. We can look forward to the summertime, which is right. When I'm sure that stuff will get announced.
You know how it is. When we get into con season, there'll be those announcements.
Yep, I'm sure I'll be sitting in the room at Comic-Con waiting for that stuff to come out. Okay, so let's go ahead and get to Twitter. I've got a few questions for you here. Question from Zaruda. He asks, do you think that the third Evangelion film's content will be forced to limit or skirt the series' traditional use of disaster imagery? I assume because of the recent disaster there.
Yeah, the earthquake and tsunami. Well, it's possible, but you remember I mentioned that when Evangelion came out in 95, it was right after the Kobe earthquake and the Om Shinrikyo gas attack.
Yeah.
So they didn't shy away from that back then. So for that reason, they might not do it now either.
Right. Why change?
Exactly. I mean, I don't think the new Evangelion, you know, the original Evangelion, when it came out, it was this very visceral, passionate thing that was made kind of, you know, almost in real time. I like to you know, we never seen anybody solo before to do like, you know, free jazz in anime before. That's what Evangelion was like. And when people said it was kind of sloppy and unprofessional, that's because they were seeing somebody improvise for the first time. And if you have a lot of talent, like Gainax has, improvisation is good. If you don't know what you're doing, of course, it's a big mess. But people who just said that that Gainax is being unprofessional, they didn't understand the fact that what they're doing was actually good. You know, and if this series was so unprofessional, how come it became so successful? You know, I think there was a certain amount of jealousy there. But the new Evangelion, you know, one of the biggest mysteries about it is, where is it going from a kind of cultural, psychological perspective? Because the new Evangelion is being made as a phenomenon. You know, you can never again make Evangelion for the first time. And now when you make Evangelion, it's something that everybody knows. It's, you know, people are kind of comfortable with it. They're familiar with it. Is Anno going to, like, bring the house down one more time? Is he going to totally troll us, you know, and like do the so-called Gainax ending, now the Kara ending, I guess? Who knows? I mean, that's really up to him. But in terms of like smashing, you know, buildings up, to be honest, I think that a lot of what people are watching the movies for is the incredible action sequences, you know, so they're going to want to see like a lot of, you know, property destruction and so forth. I doubt he's going to be like, you know, vicious about showing people being killed, you know, especially the main characters, but who knows? But again, like, if you look back at the original Evangelion, there's no reason to think that he would necessarily do that.
Yeah, I mean, as much as I would want anyone to be sensitive about that kind of thing, I would hope that that sensitivity doesn't limit them in terms of storytelling. That's really the only thing I care about. You know.
Exactly.
All right. Cowboy Dev asks, who do you think gave the strongest vocal performance in Evangelion? I assume he's talking in Japanese.
I know. I really like the French version of Gendo. he's really nasally menacing. Let's see. Strongest performance. You know, I once said that in order to faithfully reproduce the Evangelion conditions, you know, for dubbing, you'd have to lock all the voice actors in a room and like no one's getting out of here until we finish this series.
Right.
And people getting like, there was a lot of tension when the original voice recording was done. Nobody knew where Evangelion was heading. The idea that no one knew where Gendo was taking Nerve really had a parallel that no one knew where Anno was taking Gainax and taking the production. And people were feeling that tension, this idea, as the production was going on, like, where's this going? And that, of course, was filtering over to the voice actors as well. And Anno was somewhat unusual at the time as a lot of anime directors will leave, at least back then, would leave the voice acting purely up to the ADR director, the person who's the technical specialist, you know, in recording the voices. The actual director of the series itself wouldn't necessarily come in and be giving pointers and all that, but Anno did. There's a big burden on all of them. I guess Megumi Ogata, you know, had a tremendous, you know, having to play the lead and so forth. You know, probably that question is answered depending on who your favorite character is.
Yeah.
Because probably your favorite character is going to be the one who made the strongest impression on you. And part of that impression is going to be the vocal performance. So it's you know, I guess it's a highly subjective thing.
Yeah, well, yeah. That's what any your favorite is going to be an incredibly subjective question, no matter what. But yeah.
It is subjective, but that question is getting at a very excellent point, which is that the voice acting in Evangelion was at a higher psychological level, perhaps a higher artistic level than most voice acting, because people were doing it as if it actually mattered this time. And yeah, that created a lot of tension. You can't do that sort of thing all the time. To me, one of the most disheartening things that happened after Evangelion was people saying that Gainax had gone too far and that anime like that should be on late night television. Remember that Evangelion was on, I believe, at like 6:30 in the evening on Sundays. Yeah. And a lot of people said, oh, that's bad. You shouldn't have done that when younger people can see it. They're saying that shows like that should be on late at night. So you're saying that shows that push anime forward, that are actually trying to take risks, should be on late at night? So you're basically saying that anime should stay what it is, you know, that it shouldn't rock the boat. And if you pitched a show like Evangelion today, they'd never put it on at 6:30 in the evening.
Nope.
You know, it'd be a late night series. And you know what? It wouldn't become a big national phenomenon. Something else people forget about Evangelion, it was on broadcast television. You know, it wasn't on premium, you know, satellite or anything like that. And when you're on broadcast TV, it's much easier to reach the masses. 10 million people watched the final episode of Evangelion. Those were really good ratings, you know, for a mecha show. So Evangelion was able to become a phenomenon in part because it hit people by surprise. I don't know if it was totally meant as a Trojan horse, but I don't think that everybody knew what they were going, you know, getting in for. Right. When that show came in. Gainax does have a history of that, you know. Royal Space Force was the same way.
Yeah. Okay. Vicious Smith asks, you have any thoughts on Guilty Crown?
No.
Okay. Yeah. Easy one. all right. Also from Cowboy Dev says, I know you're a big Lupin the Third fan, so he has to ask green, red, or pink.
Now, the Discotheque, they're releasing the Green Jacket series, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is that out yet?
No. Summertime, right?
Are they accepting pre-orders?
I think so. You can pre-order it on Amazon. I know that.
I never thought we'd see the day that show would come out here. So it just goes to show, you know, never say never. They're all so wonderful. No, they've all got their qualities. The Green Jacket series in 1971 was maybe the first anime TV series that was really for adults. That's why it didn't last very long. It was way ahead of its time. Really shocking. And it's probably the only anime that Miyazaki ever messed up by joining it. because I love Miyazaki and he's a great filmmaker, but he's too nice a guy for Lupin. Like the song goes, you know, Lupin, he's a nice guy. I mean, Lupin was like killing people in the original episodes. If you look, Cowboy Bebop, I was reading an article once on it, and they were talking about all the influences that were on Cowboy Bebop. All of them were live action stuff, like, you know, various crime dramas, spaghetti westerns. There's only one anime, and that was the Green Jacket Lupin. And if you ever see it, and especially the original episodes, you'll know what I mean. It was this kind of very youth rebellious idea that, you know, youth heroes were dangerous. They were criminals. I mean, Lupin's a straight up criminal. He wasn't this Robin Hood guy. He was like killing and robbing. You know, he's robbing from the rich and keeping it for himself. This whole idea that Lupin was, you know, helping out people came later. That wasn't in the original manga. So anyway, but Lupin, that didn't become popular. This is 1971, 1972 again. So Lupin got relaunched in 1977 as the Red Jacket series. It was a really popular show. It ran for 3 years straight. And that's one that showed on Adult Swim. And it was pretty cool in its own way. But, you know, Lupin kind of mellowed out a bit. The Pink Jacket series, does anyone watch that? I thought it was... Have you guys seen it?
I've seen like one episode.
Yeah.
Right. So this is 1984, 85. this is like the Miami Vice era, although it actually started before that. You know, Lupin had kind of the blow-dried hairdo and the, you know, salmon pink jacket, because that's what people wore back then. Mm-hmm. You know, think about third Lupin, the pink jacket one. You know who its prime sponsor was? Nissan. So you'd be watching it and there'd be all these, you know, Nissan car commercials coming up for the Fair Lady and all that. And again, like, I'm watching this as like a 14, 15-year-old kid in America, and I'm saying, it's a cartoon, but they're advertising Nissan cars on it. So that was like telling me, hey, adults are watching this stuff in Japan. Here's evidence. You know, because kids can't buy a Nissan. Mm. I'm always interested in who the sponsors are of shows. I'm always interested in like who's running the ads in manga magazines, because that's going to tell you who the ad people think the demographic are.
Right.
You guys know about how important Dentsu is, the ad agency.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, kind of the hidden hand in so much of this. You know, in many cases, what you see as a manga or anime is just a means to an end, you know, for some advertising campaign. Am I actually answering this person's question? So,
Not really. I think he just wants to know which one you like the most.
I haven't answered it yet, have I?
No.
I think the most distinctive thing of them in terms of anime is the early Green Jacket series. Right. Like that was where it made most of its mark.
I look forward to seeing that. I don't think I've ever seen any of that. I'm glad we have the option now.
Yeah.
All right. Sewing Rose 11 asks, your notes in the Kurosawa Corpse Delivery Service volumes are very entertaining. Does Dark Horse just give you free reign?
Yeah, I mean, editors, this goes back to the fact that Dark Horse is constantly producing original books. You know, our comics have letter columns, of course. Kurosagi has notes, but other manga I work on have letter columns, like the Shinji Ikari Racing Project has a letter column. Oh My Goddess has a letter column. We want to sort of try to give you something extra.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as editor, I have to pay attention to the book anyway. Like, I have to literally go through it panel by panel because that's part of the job. So if I notice something that's interesting or kind of strikes me, you know, I'm going to talk about it. Some of the notes are mine. Some of the notes are from the translator, Toshifumi Yoshida, again, who I've known for a really long time back at Viz.
Mm-hmm.
But also I think that because Kurosagi in particular is a story that's set in modern day Tokyo, it can kind of help you get more out of the story if I kind of explain some of the references. And I think note sections are good to do that. I personally don't like putting notes like in the margins or actually on the manga page, because I think it kind of takes you out of the story for a moment.
Mm.
And as long as you don't absolutely need it to understand what's going on in the scene, I don't think you should put a note in a page. I have like asterisk notes, but they're usually humorous ones, like she's lying or something like that. And those are sometimes in the original, by the way. Kosuke Fujishima likes to do that. The only problem is people have to copy edit it, you know, because like it's 3,000, 4,000 words a volume, and someone's got to go through it and check all the semicolons, you know, and the, you know, M dashes versus the N dashes. But fortunately, people here are kind enough to do that.
Okay. All right. You know, we had a lot of appreciation for your liner notes in many of your various projects, K-Man. People really love those. The consensus is in on that one, I think.
Remember, anyone reading the books I'm working on, the reason we have letters columns, the reason we have notes is it's an invitation for you to get involved, too.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually running our first piece of Kurosagi fan art in Volume 12. So, if you'd like to be a part of the book, that's cool. We're totally down with that. And again, that's coming out of the American comics tradition where you have fan art, where you have letters and all that, you know,
right
in.
Any plans to introduce a coolometer?
Nothing like that, I don't think.
Okay. Okay. So Ed Chavez wants to know, has Golgo or Duke Togo been assigned to do something about TEPCO yet? And if so, what was the result? I don't think you have to answer that.
I don't think so. I mean, anybody who's read Golgo 13 knows that he once saved Los Angeles from nuclear meltdown.
Right.
So maybe the problem is that they do that story, people are going to ask, hey, why didn't you save Japan from nuclear meltdown?
Right.
You know, the guy who's been all over TEPCO is one of my favorite manga, Kosaku Shima, which runs in Morning.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
my tastes in manga are either really bizarre or really boring, depending on how you look at it. Because I love Saruman manga. They're manga for people my age, which is 41. And, like, you know, I wish there were more anime for people my age. And theoretically, there should be, because there are lots of anime for people in their 40s. And, you know, anime are based on manga, right? Many of them are, so. But, you know, anime manga that are meant for older readers often get adapted into live-action series, as you might know. There seems to be a kind of decision, well, this will be a good anime, but this will make a good live-action series. But, you know, who knows? Anyway, Kosaku Shima has done a lot of stuff about TEPCO and about that situation. You know who's been doing stuff about that also is, you know, Yoshinori Kobayashi?
I heard of him.
Yeah, he's kind of a notorious mangaka. Some of the most interesting manga in Japan are not published in manga magazines. They're published in general interest magazines that might run a manga feature. Mm. Like, for example, Lone Wolf and Cub, the sequel to Lone Wolf and Cub did not run in a manga magazine. It ran in a men's magazine. And there's this magazine in Japan called Sapio. It's kind of like U.S. News and World Report. And it runs this manga called Gomanizu Sengen Gosen, which means the Arrogance Manifesto. It's a little bit notorious because it can kind of come off with a kind of nationalist slant. And Kobayashi is one of those guys who thinks that the Japanese spent the 30s and 40s passing out candy to everyone in Asia. Mm. You know, that everything they did was to free people from imperialism and, like, you know. But anyway, but nevertheless, he's also a guy who doesn't shy away from controversy. And if he thinks there's corruption going on in Japan, corruption in the industries, corruption in politics, he's right there. He's been doing a lot about the work the Self-Defense Force has been doing in the tsunami-hit areas. And because the Self-Defense Force has been out, you know, with recovery efforts, and they've had the really terrible job of, you know, recovering the dead, you know, which is, we're talking about thousands of dead people. And, you know, it's really psychologically racking, you know, work and stuff that there's nothing that prepares you for that in Japanese life. You know, it's been so long since Japan has had a war and had to deal with having to recover all these bodies. So Kobayashi has been doing all that recently in Sapio. He's been talking about that. So, but I think in many ways it's a somewhat, oh, it's coming up in Kurosagi. So it's going to be in Kurosagi volume 15. So here's another guy who doesn't shy away from controversy, Eiji Otsuka, who of course is the writer of the Kurosagi Corpse Delivery Service and MPD Psycho. And as some of you guys might know, anybody who's listening to this who is in Montreal, Eiji Otsuka will actually be appearing in Montreal in a few days, I believe the 4th of the 6th. He's going to be talking at Concordia University. They're having a presentation there. So by all means, if you're anywhere in that area, this is a rare chance to actually meet a mangaka, because those guys don't get out to North America very often.
Hmm. Huh. All right. Okay. Exodore US asks, given your reputation for dressing well, do you prefer American, British, or Italian style tailoring for your suits?
My tailor is a guy in San Jose. He's a Mexican immigrant, came from Guadalajara, I believe, about 30 years ago. And so I guess you'd say, I favor Mexican American tailoring.
Okay. Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
All right. And we've got two left here briefly. V guy wants to know if you know whether or not the digital distribution of Sadamoto's Evangelion manga has been working out. Do you know whether or not the download numbers are doing okay?
I don't know.
Okay. Simple enough. And finally, we'll wrap with this one. I think this is a good one to end on. Carl, from Gav on Twitter. Carl, if you threw a room party based around your work life and environment, what would the theme drink be?
Coffee.
Okay. That's a hell of a party you're throwing there.
Well, he did ask what my work life, you know, so.
There you go.
That's the most honest drink.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, I think we've all learned a lot here. Thank you so much for coming by and sharing stories with us. That was very educational and interesting. So thank you so much for coming by. We really do appreciate it.
Thanks. And, thank you everyone for listening, and thank you so much for reading Dark Horse Manga.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Carl for coming on by. The theme song's called Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can find them at thenewdivision.net. And don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a little rating and review. We would appreciate it. And we will see you all next week.